about the future of criminal law. People often want to see into the future, and today that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at what's going to happen. What is the future? Some people say that technology is the future, but we all know that the real future is globalization. And what globalization is going to bring us is international computer crime laws. Not global at first, but eventually that's what we're moving towards. And what I want to look at is the first major, probably to be successful, initiative to have an international computer crime law. Why do we need international computer crime laws? Because the internet is an international system. Because computer crime and crime of all sorts now can cross boundaries. In the old days, I had to go into the library with the candlestick if I was going to kill Colonel Mustard. I had to actually physically be there. And while being there, I could leave behind all sorts of evidence, from fingerprints to hair samples, eyewitnesses who may have seen me enter the room, all the way to today, leaving behind DNA. Now, I can be the criminal in one country, I can attack a victim in another country, and the evidence can be strewn in any number of countries in between. And police hate that. But there is some major obstacles towards developing a uniform theory of what computer crime should be. And what are those obstacles? First of all, there's a lot of areas of agreement, which in most of the European nations and in the United States, we have a consensus as to what should be illegal. And some of those areas of obvious agreement, where there's not a lot of problem for people to say, yes, I agree, that should be illegal, are, for example, with child pornography, the destruction of data, data theft. These are offenses which we can tend to agree ought to be made illegal. But there are great areas of disagreement. One of the major areas of disagreement is substantive. What is or what should be a crime? And countries don't necessarily agree on this, even in some basic ways. For example, in the United States, unauthorized access, simple trespass to a computer without permission is a crime. Other countries may not have a statute that prohibits that at all, or when they do have a statute that prohibits it, they may have some added additional things that go with it. They don't think that simple trespass is a crime. For example, in Germany, their unauthorized access computer crime law requires that the person have circumvented some kind of security measure in order for that trespass to then be unauthorized. So if you just happen upon the password file in a web server in the United States, you could be convicted of unauthorized access because you exceeded your authorization when you went to look at this password file. In Germany, that wouldn't be the case. The people just left their password file on the web server without any kind of security protection or means of authenticating permissible viewers, so it wouldn't be a crime under that statute. So even with something as simple as unauthorized access, we can have a great disagreement. Another problem is the relative competence or incompetence of local law enforcement officials. Here in the United States, we've had a lot of effort to try to train our FBI agents to be up to snuff in the techniques necessary to do a good forensic analysis of computer crime data. In other countries, they do not have the resources necessarily or screensaver. They don't have the resources necessarily or the information or the expertise for them to investigate computer crimes in such a way as to necessarily find the proper perpetrator or to do it in a way in which it could be used in a court, for example, in the United States, where you're going to have defense attorneys to challenge that evidence. There may be somebody who commits an offense in another country, and the United States is interested in locating and prosecuting that person. But local law enforcement authorities here may have little or no power to go to another country where the perpetrator may be located or where the evidence may be located to investigate. So there's no agreement on what powers one nation has to interrogate, search, seize evidence in another nation, and nations differ from country to country as to what kind of privacy protections they have for their internet users, and thus what kind of evidence they can permissibly collect from an ISP. And the question is then, can they simply seize evidence from the ISP? Do they just have to request it? Do they need a court order or perhaps a warrant, or do they need nothing? Or is there no way for them to obtain that information? Is it so protected you can't, a law enforcement person can't get it at all? There's the territorial problem with the lack of cooperation between a local law enforcement agency one nation's law enforcement agency and the nation and the law enforcement agency of another nation. We've all seen those movies where the FBI comes in and the local police are mad because they're on their territory. Well, that sort of internecine rivalry is that many more times worse when we're not even talking about officials in the same country. And finally, if we do manage to discover who is the perpetrator of an offense and where they are located, there are disagreements over whether we have the authority, one nation has the authority, to bring that person to that country for trial, and whether the home nation is going to extradite that person. So all of these elements make, at this point in time, international computer crime difficult to deal with. Let's look at some examples. Who's familiar with the I Love You virus case? Okay, so I won't go into it in too much detail. A gentleman in the Philippines decided it wasn't fair that no one in the Philippines could afford internet access. He thought a good way for people to get internet access would be to use the accounts of other people and to have their passwords. So he wrote, as part of his school paper, a virus that would go out through the internet and it would collect passwords. This I Love You virus, and it was an email that was titled I Love You, and of course everybody always hopes that somebody loves them. So when you would get an email from your friend that said I love you, you would click on it, open it up, and what it would do is it would go through all your email addresses, if you happen to use Microsoft Outlook, and send itself to all of those people, a note from you saying that you loved them. And there were great complications for corporate networks as they tried to clean this bug out of their system, but essentially what it was supposed to do was harvest these passwords and send them home. Eventually, the United States authorities, with the cooperation of the Philippines, was able to trace this virus back to a small apartment in Manila where this gentleman lived with his girlfriend, or with his sister and her boyfriend, I believe. And eventually, at first they thought it was the boyfriend, but when this guy's school told the authorities that actually he'd written his graduate thesis paper on exactly this topic, they realized that it was him. So, corporations here in the United States were claiming millions of dollars of loss for all the time and effort that they had to take to clean this virus out of their system because everybody was getting way too many emails. And they were eager to prosecute this sort of latter-day Robin Hood here in the United States or in the Philippines, just so long as something happened to him. But it turned out that the Philippines does not have, or rather did not have, a law against writing and sending viruses. So there was nothing to prosecute him for, and this gentleman was set free, much to the consternation of local authorities here in the United States. Of course, bad cases always make bad law, and Philippines ran out to quickly pass a antivirus law, which in the long run is a good thing, but at the time, since there was no law, it couldn't be applied to him prospectively, and this gentleman, there's no legal recourse. There's no legal punishment that can befall him. And that was extremely aggravating to the United States. but not as aggravating in some ways as the case involving the Russians. Because at least in the I Love You virus case, the Philippines was cooperative. In the case involving the these two Russians, the let me just add that because it was not a crime in the Philippines in, with the gentleman who wrote the I Love You virus, he could not then be extradited to the United States for trial here, even though it is a crime here in the United States. So nothing could be done. With the Russians, these were two Russian guys who had stolen a bunch of credit card information, done some other stuff, but basically stolen a bunch of credit card information from companies like PayPal, which is an online payment provider. And the FBI, with some assistance, was eventually able, after a year or so of investigation, to trace these thefts back to Russia. They called the Russian authorities and asked them for assistance, and the Russians simply did not return their telephone calls. They could not get the Russians to be interested in arresting these two guys. Not only couldn't they get them interested in arresting the two guys or interrogating the two guys, they couldn't get them to even collect any evidence over there from these two guys. Their requests for assistance were totally ignored, and the United States has no power to obtain a search warrant for a computer server that's located in Russia. Without that information, they couldn't charge them here, and of course, without the cooperation of the Russian authorities, they couldn't extradite them here to the United States. So the FBI came up with a great social engineering hack. They didn't have Russian cooperation, they didn't have any evidence, and they didn't have great technological expertise. But what they did do was they set up a fake company in Seattle, and they called these Russian guys up, and they said, hey, we've got this computer security company, and we think you guys are really good. We might want to hire you. Why don't you guys fly here to Seattle for an interview? So these two guys, you know, times are tough. The economy's bad. So these two guys flew from Russia to Seattle to go to this company, Invita, it was appropriately called. And while they were there, they went through the sort of interviewing process, and the FBI agents, posing as human resources personnel, said, well, you know, show us what you can do. Hack into our network. So the Russian guys sat down at the company computers and logged into their server in Russia to get their hacking tools that they had stored there. Unbeknownst to them, the FBI had a sniffer running on that system and captured their username and password. After they entered that information into the computer, the Russians were arrested, and with that username and password, the FBI logged onto the server in Russia, collected that information, brought it over here to the United States, zipped it up, then went and got a search warrant to open the file that they had downloaded from Russia, after having obtained it. The defense attorney in that case did challenge that on Fourth Amendment grounds, and the judge denied his motion, but I'm sure that it will be appealed. So with cases like that, there's been an immense interest on the part of international law enforcement to try to come to some kind of terms of cooperation, some terms of agreement, so that we don't have these problems that arise in the future. The Council of Europe's cybercrime treaty is the most developed and the most advanced of these efforts. Something of a gleam in the eye of the Hoover Institution only 4 years ago, it's now rapidly on its way towards ratification. And we're going to talk in detail about the provisions of that treaty, but I just want to mention that there's been a lot of international cooperation in many fields other than crime lately. The G8, which is the eight industrial nations, has also been very concerned with cybercrime and has developed a list of principles which have been incorporated into the Council of Europe treaty. We've also seen international treaties on copyright law and a new one that we're in the process of debating, which is the Hague Treaty, which is about the enforcement of foreign judgments. Now, you may remember, as I said, globalization is the future. Internationalism is the trend. And we are looking at a vast effort to homogenize the law across nations, most often in the way that the United States thinks the law ought to be. With conventions or treaties like the Berne Convention or the WIPO Treaty, we're looking at exporting the United States view of what copyright law is to other nations. And if you'll remember, it is the WIPO Treaty that brought us the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and I know that that was discussed here at this conference earlier, so I won't belabor it, but you know, I think we're familiar with the problems that the DMCA poses for people doing research, for reverse engineering, for encryption research, and other important and valuable efforts of that nature. You know, basically, Mickey Mouse is getting his way, and the rest of us are going to have to follow in step. The Hague Treaty is even more dangerous in many ways. The Hague Treaty is a treaty that's designed to enforce foreign judgments. Now, most treaties, and the Council of Europe's Cybercrime Treaty I include in this, want the signatories, the countries that join the treaty, to change or amend their laws to be in accordance with what the treaty says. The Hague Treaty is a little bit different in that what it says is whatever your law may be, we're going to respect that here in the other countries that are members of the treaty. So instead of saying, here's what our basic standards are going to be for the law, the Hague Treaty says, hey, if you break the law in this country or that country, and there's a judgment against you, we're going to let that judgment be enforced here in the United States. So if you get sued for defamation or libel or something like that in the United Kingdom, which does not have the same free speech protections we have here, and there's a judgment against you, here in the United States, we're going to allow that judgment to be enforced. So this is not about the Hague Treaty. Perhaps it should be, and we can talk more about that later. But the Hague Treaty raises a lot of problems, and those problems, basically the problems of differences in values, differences in procedure, differences in protections for privacy, free speech, and important rights of that nature, are those are problems we're going to see here with cybercrime, and also that are very much issues with the Hague Treaty. I have a question there. The question was whether the Hague Treaty prevents our government from prosecuting us for foreign laws. And while the Hague Treaty does not prevent that, here in the United States, you can be prosecuted under United States laws. Our government has to enforce our laws. So the Hague Treaty will not give our government new power to prosecute for other laws, but what it will do is it will say that our government has to enforce judgments in other countries under their laws. So as I said, if you were sued in the United Kingdom for insulting McDonald's, and McDonald's won a judgment against you there, then the United States government would be a party or a accomplice to enforcing that judgment against you here, even though under United States law, your comments about McDonald's would have been protected under the First Amendment and not something for which you could have been sued civilly. Okay? The gentleman with the white hat? He's asking who it applies to, and that's a good question, because obviously if it applies to, we certainly don't want judgments from some countries whose laws are extremely different from ours to be enforced here. For example, if you were violated the ankle-showing law in Afghanistan, and now I'm going to get caned, we certainly wouldn't want that judgment to be enforced against me here in the United States. It would be something of a spectacle. But it's for nations that sign the Hague Treaty or any of these treaties. And right now, as with the Cybercrime Treaty, we're basically looking at the Western Europe nations. With Cybercrime Treaty, it's the Western European nations plus the I forget what they call them right now, but sort of the friendly observer nations, the United States, Canada, Japan, and maybe one other that we're looking at as inviting to be members of this treaty. Yes, you. Okay, so this is a basic jurisdiction question, and the answer to that is if you do something from United States soil, you are subject to United States law, even if it affects someone outside the country. If you do something from outside the country that affects someone on United States soil, then again, you're probably subject to United States law. Now, whether you can get here or not, whether we'll get you here or not is part of that whole extradition treaty question. But so the answer is, while I'm not a specialist in British law, I think the answer is the same. If the server is in the United Kingdom and people can read it in a Usenet group there, even though you're located here, theoretically you could be subject to United Kingdom law. However, this is part of the whole problem, or part of the whole good thing about the Internet, which is that what are they going to do? I mean, who's going to prosecute you for something you've done over there? But also, how can they stop you? For example, when Yahoo had people selling Nazi memorabilia across their network, they're subject to laws in Germany and France and other nations that prohibit the selling of that kind of material. But so what are they going to do? They take that stuff off of yahoo.fr, but you can still get that on yahoo.com, and a person in France can easily access yahoo.com. So that is one of the issues with the Internet. You know, are we going to have a basic dumbing down where all we see on the Internet is what's palatable to every nation, the lowest common denominator, or are we going to see a higher level of discourse on the Internet where, what's appropriate, where we don't have those kinds of restrictions?